Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Talking the Cure, Hogan Lovett's Life Sciences and Healthcare Podcast. In this two-part series, Arne Thielmann is leading the conversation with Richard Backhaus and Lars Cornells, discussing the integration and implication of digital health, artificial intelligence, and legal considerations in the medical device industry. They explore how traditional companies like Dräger adapt to digital innovation, the role of AI and software in life sciences, and the challenges and opportunities presented by regulatory environments. They delve into specific legal frameworks such as European Union's data strategy and the AI Act, discussing their impact on innovation and data access. The conversation also touches on practical use of AI in legal work, the future of the profession, and the broader implication of AI on society and human behavior. So Arne, pick it up from here, please.
In general, we would probably say the basic idea is a good one, to have a process that is based on a self-declaration, which is the CE marking process. However, with the help of a notified body, and that then again also a question of resources. You've seen this in the MDR.
Yeah, absolutely.
The notified bodies will require resources to deal with this certification process of AI. What do you think the interplay between the Medical Device Regulation, AI Act, does it make sense at the moment? And maybe for those who haven't yet looked into that, yeah, the idea is to have an integrated process where the notified body that is certified both under the MDR and under the AI Act would be certifying the medical device that involves AI. So the general idea is a streamlined one. Do you think this process makes sense, especially in terms of learning software? And we do have some language in the AI Act on how a conformity assessment might not be needed if a software learns that is integrated in a medical device. How do you see that? I think it's Article 46, and I promised before not to mention an article, but you know, as a lawyer, you sometimes you can't just let that go. But yeah, what do you think on this tension between medical devices, repeatability and reliability of the same results as compared to learning software and all that in a conformity assessment environment?
Yeah, well, probably let's approach it in two steps. First, there is a general tension between classic product regulation, especially in the industries we are in, and the IT industry per se. Generally speaking, the medical device industry, for example, or life science industry, has been very high on quality, zero failure tolerance, a slow industry. Whereas look at how many times you get an update on your smartphone. The classic IT industry is a quick-moving, fast limitation of liability industry. And that's a general tension you see also in the deterministic world of software, where you simply see that the general software company's perspective is very risk-averse, fast-moving, let's put something on the market, where we want to have this, or need to have, want and need to have, the safe product. And that there might be a gap between people that provide the software and say, well, I don't want to have that used in any risky area, and us having to use software in something which is, by the very nature of its application, life critical. So that's the basic challenge you have with this digitized life science industry per se. Look at telecommunications. There's a statutory limitation of liability for communication failures in the German Telecommunications Act. On the other hand, if you look at any kind of, well, SMS communication or mobile connectivity communication for critical purposes, that's not a good fit, right? Just want to emphasize that there is a bit of a mismatch between how the classic IT industry was working in certain parts and what we did with our classical boxes and touchable products. And this predictability and reliability thing is put to fundamental new issues with regards to anything that's AI. I don't know what you've experienced, but if I put in the same prompt into a large language model at different times, there might be different answers. And that's more or less kind of the contrary to what we wanted to have as reliability in the past. Now, that's a general challenge. What's your perspective?
I think that the life cycle of a software or everything that is included there is going to be a big challenge. As Richard said, IT or software market and this perspective of a medical device manufacturing or any other regulated market is quite different. And this is going to be a big challenge. Looking at AI and looking at the situation where you well said the notified body shall be responsible for both the AI Act and the medical device regulation, well, that's going to be interesting because this would mean that the AI Act is going to be considered by somebody who's highly trained in MDR and who brings a certain perspective to the table. And having the AI Act considered under this perspective might not be the best case for us as Germany or as a market that is going to have to move forward quite quickly and has to foster innovation. I would rather think that the good thing is that you have to talk to the same person for all the... Yeah. Yeah, it's a one-stop solution. Yeah. But I don't think that the stop might be the best. And I don't see that... Yeah, I wouldn't like that the perspective that is currently used is going to be implemented for the AI Act as well.
Basically, what I think is, in essence, the idea of having an integrated conformity assessment with the one regulatory or notified body basically underlines or emphasizes the question mark whether it is the right idea to have a horizontal regulation on that. Because in the end, you change, it's horizontal, it remains a horizontal regulation, but for practical purposes, you try to integrate it into the vertical regulation by the MDR. And maybe it would have been the better way to simply say, well, it's going to be integrated on an application risk focus per se, and you take it from there. But it's a done deal. We will have to wait and see what's going to happen. And in any case, I mean, the things, and we may probably focus, look at that in further detail. I think the general perspectives of the AI Act, what to look for, they make sense. But they may not just make sense for AI, they make sense for every product. In essence, the headlines are kind of a Magna Carta of what you should reasonably do with a product that might entail any danger to any individual or public good.
And for some, it might mean more regulation, but for others, as you said, coming from the highly regulated medical device world, it might not be that much more. The exciting question is, how can, for instance, large language models be integrated per se in the medical device world? And you mentioned that aspect that there can be different answers to the same question because it's based on probabilities and in combination with the temperature that decides to take different words rather than the most probable one that creates something new every time you type in a prompt. But at the same time, you have different results, even to the same question. You might have different results if you type in the same questions 1 year later after the software learned. And there's a general tension between the medical device world per se, probably, when it comes to that aspect. So do you hear, like from the field, from clinicians, that they're using already large language models in practice? Does it create sometimes some form of risk also for the Dräger world? And I'm just mentioning that because, for instance, when simple physical product iPads came into the world, every doctor wanted to see its CT images on an iPad screen because it's just easier. But at the same time, it's not a screen that was certified in the medical world. So you had this clash years ago already where you saw some like individual request to use certain technology or to combine it. And I mean, we will certainly also see many people, doctors, using large language models also for medical questions, and maybe base their further treatment with devices of several companies on that basis. Is this something you need to address, or you already see in practice?
Yeah, well, I think the honest answer is we don't really know, because we are obviously close to the business, but not close to what's really happening on the desktop computer of a medical practitioner. But we can probably look into that from what we do, are we as lawyers doing with these kind of models, right? Because in essence, the materiality is a different one, or the content is a different one. But the question is, what can you do with such models in a profession that's very much based on knowledge and education and how to do things and how to recognize things? Might be very similar for medical practitioners and lawyers.
As far as the knowledge base goes, I think it's mostly the same even. And this doesn't give me that much hope, actually. Because let's be honest, I think we all play a lot with ChatGPT, also with the newest versions, and because it's interesting. But my experience is not that great, at least for the specific legal tasks, not maybe drafting a document that's not that important or stuff like that. But for the really legal questions that need to be solved, well, I don't think that ChatGPT, for example, performs like a lawyer.
Do you have an example for maybe a good response where you thought, oh, this was
a good legal response?
Good one and a really bad one?
I haven't seen a good legal response, actually. I think we asked them to write liability clauses, and they came up with a standard liability clause. Yeah, and that was fine. Yeah, that was a good experience. The bad experience was everything else.
That's easy. On your side, Rita?
Yeah, so two things. First, we probably very early with putting in internal regulation with regards to large language models. So as soon as ChatGPT was open to the public, we were on top of this. When that was a great team effort also with the data privacy colleagues, that I think a week after, 2 weeks after, we had an internal guidance out with regards to what not to do with ChatGPT in the first place. So we've been watching that and tackling that quite early. So basically, what we don't use it for real data, we have used it for abstract questions, depersonalized things and stuff. And what I personally, I do write glossaries on judgments every once in a while as a kind of hobby. And all these court judgment summaries that I try to use any large language model, and I try to fear for, it was kind of consistent from the language perspective, but it was full of hallucinations, right? And some of you may have read this Stanford report on artificial intelligence and lawyering, and that it massively hallucinates, and that it's not very good at the details, right? And the texts are kind of consistent, or on first sight consistent, but sometimes it created or said that there's something in the judgment of the court which I haven't found by reading it a couple of times. So there is quite a lot of uncertainty in that. But there are two things that fascinate me with these models. And they are not that much, well, they are not only output related. What I think is good with regards to output, I think all these models are quite good. And there's also this DeepL-Write AI thing to improve the text you've written. So finding inconsistencies, it's much better than F7 for Windows and Word to find typos and spelling mistakes. And to bring something which might be too complicated for the audience you need it for, or to customize it to the audience. That's something, if you have a text that's created by a human, by yourself, and you want to craft it in a different way, or make it easier or something, or create bullets out of it, that's quite useful. also to challenge what you've done already to get another. It's like kind of sparring. That's kind of loose. It's good with language in general. And some people say sometimes I talk too complicated and use too many Latin phrases and stuff. So it eradicates Latin phrases. That's good. What I find most fascinating is that, and that might be one of the most the greatest game changers in that, is that you have a humanized interface. You don't have an interface kind of anymore, because it understands you kind of, or we feel that we are understood. And that's something which I still find incredible.
Yeah, and it's going to be much, much more interesting in the next couple of months or even years, because let's be honest, it's going to get better. And moving away from maybe, let's say, is it able to be a lawyer? Well, currently I think it's not, but to be honest, looking at the broader picture and our organization, obviously we have lots and lots of projects running right now using AI and testing AI. May it be, for example, in the marketing and corporate communications divisions, where, well, obviously Midjourney and all the others are tested right now, which brings up lots and lots of legal questions, for example, copyright law, et cetera, et cetera. We all know that and love it. We have the GitHub Copilot and other copilots running, which I think will be a huge, huge shift for the software development industry. I think it's going to be happening. And looking at all of this, it's going to be a huge change. What's coming out of this, I don't think that anybody right now can say, well, this is going to lead us in 5 years from now. And I think everybody would be really, really good advised with keeping on top of the innovation and looking at it and using it and trying it out. So when it becomes a really, really powerful tool, you are able to use the tool as long as the tool is not going to be the next you. So you still have 10 years left, maybe.
Yeah, we're touching about the large social economic questions now, aren't we? Now, I think it's mandatory for any knowledge worker in order to stay competitive, to play around with all this stuff. And to be honest, as lawyers, I don't know whether we need artificial intelligence. And don't get me wrong, it's definitely going to change the profession. But a lot of things we do, if we are honest, are deterministic. You can put it into a classic flowchart with yes or no answers and come up with the right answer. So that's something you could do. And I'm not saying that we do it on the scale I want to, but a lot of things and questions that come across, at least an in-house lawyer, but thinking back at our times as attorneys in private practice, won't be that much different. A lot of questions could be answered in a classic flowchart by way of software. It's a question whether you have the economies of scale to build that. And the funny thing is, if you build something, can do it for contracts, like everyone starts with the NDA, because it's rather standardized and relatively short and simple. But if you build it, and we did that a couple of years ago already, put it into a flowchart, it's quite baroque, right? You see what the human brain is actually doing just automatically to come up with the right result. And if you have to put it into a deterministic programming or even a flowchart without the programming, it's quite a large task. But that shows that in principle, knowledge work and legal work is not prone to automation even without AI. But we will probably see that's what we are going to experiment with this year, is not to that much solve the real legal questions, the details of complex agreements and stuff. Maybe we can work on that, trying to improve language, one thing. I think that's something which offers incredible chances in general, is to come up with tailor-made responses for the audience. So what AI will enable us is to craft content or tailor-made content for the audience or the interacting person, whether it should be easy, professional tone, language, all that stuff. So a relatively clear use case for playing around with AI would be to put in like internal company regulations or FAQs and try to look whether you can box and ring fence AI to allow people to talk to your company rules rather than starting with complex legal agreements where you will have, in negotiations at least, unless AI negotiates with AI, human interaction anyway, right?
I see where this is going. You want to implement a chatbot where your colleagues internally have to turn to first because they call you.
Basically, what we will see also in our organizations, or probably also with clients in private practice, is that we now, at least on the professional level, have more and more digital natives interacting with us. And whereas the boomer is still taking up the telephone, we don't have telephones anymore, but is giving you a call to get to an answer, probably people younger than 10 to 15 years younger, and there are people working already, than we are, feel quite comfortable with putting in anonymous question into the internal legal chatbot.
Yeah, they might even prefer that.
Maybe.
Some say that the trust in chatbots is actually much higher than in terms of humans. There are studies on trust.
Oh, really?
I didn't know that. Medical advice given by a person and given by a chatbot, and there is study data that says the trust is actually higher in the chatbot.
Maybe the chatbot is better at adapting to.
It sounds better, and then this is one of the other aspects you mentioned. It sounds very convincing when you read it, but sometimes it does not. It's just not accurate. So some people say these large language models are also a little bit like mansplaining as a service. It's very convincing,
as a service,
but not necessarily true.
Yeah.
So, which leads us again to what you said is, will it replace lawyers? Probably not entirely, because you need people that check the results of it. But in a way, it will probably, will I be replaced by AI? Probably not. But will I be replaced by people using AI? Very likely, yes.
Yeah, and also your profession might change a bit. Yeah, maybe you will be the one who is creating the AI or training it or working with it, but not necessarily the one who's talking to the client. Because you can only talk to one client, and your AI can talk to, well, let's say, yeah, unlimited clients at the same time. And I think that there will be a market for let's say, tailor-made legal advice for the very, very important questions. There will also be a market for more efficiency and lesser transaction costs. And that's also true for our organization. Well, yeah, we can give maybe more tailored advice to certain groups, but we can also limit transaction costs. And there are lots and lots of things where you don't need the tailored suit, but you just need the hammer, and that's fine as well. So I think those two.
Yeah, but as I tried to make clear earlier, that's not necessarily related to AI. That's putting general efficiency practices that we have identified in manufacturing first to knowledge work. That's what Richard Susskind wrote more than a decade ago. And the question is, so, or to use Susskind's words again, he kind of said that a company doesn't need lawyers, it needs solution for legal problems. And if you focus this way, we will probably be in the future, even more than we are now, not lawyers in the first place, but solvers of legal problems by various means. And that will definitely include more digitization in general, may include elements of AI, but will also include human creativity and human interaction. And that's definitely going to be and stay a place for us. I'm pretty sure that the work won't be gone.
Probably not.
No.
Yeah, I think that really was a journey through a couple of different fields. I thank you very much. I think we almost closed the loop between tradition and innovation, be it on the medical device side, but also on the legal side and how legal work could be in the future. Maybe to end with, what's the next question that you will type into your large language model of choice?
I would rather use a prompt to prompt maybe Midjourney and create maybe a nice picture for my background on my desktop.
That's good.
The largest question that's laying on my mind with regards to all of that is, what will this do with us as humans? How do we, in such a quick moving world, change our behaviors, our thinking, or at least our deep thinking, not system one, but system two thinking, when everything and every answer seems to be just around the corner by typing it in? How do we continue to rethink? Because the answers to the world's problems aren't not that, well, there are questions that haven't been answered in the world. And the key question is, how do we as humans stay curious and competitive?
Thank you very much. Enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was a real pleasure and interesting insights. And let's get back to this in another 5 years and say where we're at. See where we're at.
Yeah, although I think we won't need 5 years. I think 6 months will be better. Because given the time scales that we're looking at AI, so let's see again in 6 months, I would say. And thanks so much for having us. 1 hour is much, much too less to really talk about those things, unfortunately.
Thank you very much. And yeah, let's see what the future brings. Thank you.
That's it for today. If you have further questions for Arne, Richard or Lars, you can find their contacts in the show notes. In addition, don't forget to subscribe to this podcast so you're not going to miss out on any future episodes. Give us a 5-star rating and follow us on LinkedIn, as we're sharing a lot of interesting content there. So let's close this out. Thank you for joining. See you in about 2 weeks when we're talking The Cure.